the week of July 5th, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 286, the podcast that brings you all the dirt and the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Vancouver, Canada, I'm Michael Giltz. USA! USA!
Okay, I take it you're in Vancouver because it's lovely this time of year.
Soccer, football, women, champions. That's why I'm here.
Okay, so you were a part of the women's national team that won the U.S. Well, not the
you
U.S.
You didn't see me on TV?
Oh, were you the one lifting? There was a shiny object. I couldn't figure out what was going on. There were a whole bunch of women hugging and crying.
The water boy. I was the water boy.
Oh, okay.
We don't have the final numbers yet, but it was a big hit on television. Clearly, when a U.S. soccer team wins the World Cup, Americans will pay attention.
That's true. Now, we're talking about the FIFA Women's World Cup 2015 championship.
That's right, and they triumphed again. It's their third World Cup or second?
It's their third World Cup, but I think the first time since 1999.
Well, that's okay. I mean, you don't win the World Cup every 4 years, so that's really not that unusual. But exciting to see. It's great. Clearly, every 4 years for World Cup for women and men, America is now paying attention. People come in from all over the world to live in America. They love soccer. People who are here in America have got the bug. Just like the Olympics, every 4 years, people watch gymnastics and swimming and wrestling and things like that they never pay attention to otherwise. That's where soccer is right now. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. People are not starting to flock to games. They're not starting to watch it on TV during the regular season all year long. We're not there yet. Maybe we'll get there someday soon. We got to raise the quality, get more fans out there. It's a great sport. But as far as once every 4 years, yes, America is finally on board with soccer.
Well, I'm a little confused. Can we go back for a second? Because what you're saying, if I get you correct, if I am understanding you properly here, is that swimming and gymnastics and some of those other sports you mentioned, they actually happen when there is no, you know, when the Olympics aren't on?
Yes. Yes, they do.
Oh, okay. I'll have to look that up on my TV guide, or I don't know where I'll find it.
Well, you got to go to Big Ten Network on cable or whatever. That's where you get a lot of the classic old Olympic sports, because most schools don't even play them anymore. So it's a real shame. But anyway, people are on board for soccer now, at least for World Cup, and people are on board for Showbiz Sandbox. What are we going to be talking about this week?
Well, Michael, you may not have noticed this, but, and it's, I know it's hard to believe, but we've passed the halfway mark on 2015, so on this week's show, we're going to take a look at which movies have come out on top at the box office. And not only in the United States or North America, we'll take a peek at the box office returns in territories from around the world, including China and India. Now, we bet you can't guess who is at the top of the charts when it comes to music sales this year. Taylor Swift. But what's noteworthy here is that this artist's album, Taylor Swift, was actually released last year, not this year. On Inside Baseball, we'll catch you
up. Do you need a glass of water? Are you okay?
No, I have a little Taylor Swift in my throat.
Oh, well.
Okay. Yeah, okay. That actually came out wrong, but you know what I mean.
Keep going. Keep going.
Okay, we're going to catch you up on Inside Baseball on a lot of music news, including the best-selling albums and singles, the funky way Billboard tries to convert streams into album sales, the resurgence of vinyl, and more. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. We're talking about movies from around the world. We pull our information from RentTrak. We have a link to their site in our show notes. They're our primary source for worldwide box office. And the number one movie around the world with bragging rights to trump all other films with $102 million on opening weekend is Terminator, Genesis, and Nobody Cares.
Yes, that's true. And even Arnold Schwarzenegger's like, I'm in a new movie? I didn't know.
Actually, he was out there pounding the pavement. He did a good job promoting the film. In America, we had the July 4th weekend, so it's kind of a bad weekend for movies because July 4th fell on Saturday. Everyone was watching fireworks and barbecuing. So a lot of our movies opened up on Wednesday. So in America, we have like a five-day weekend is what we're looking at this week, because that's where a lot of money was made for Terminator and Magic Mike XXL and so on. So Terminator Genesis has made $102 million over the weekend, but it's five-day total, mostly because of North America. That's at $130 million and counting. Unfortunately, even though that's close to the film's budget, it got very bad reviews. It underperformed in North America. It's just not doing well. It doesn't have good word of mouth. We have to wait to see where it ends up, of course. And it will overperform overseas compared to the U.S., but it has to if it has any chance of making back its money.
Now, I've got a question. Do you ever use the GPS or map application on your iPhone called Waze, W-A-Z-E?
Don't even know if I have it.
Okay, well, I have for the past 2 weeks, Arnold Schwarzenegger has been bossing me around throughout Los Angeles. Wherever, whenever I drive, he's, you know, the voice has been turned into Arnold Schwarzenegger in a promotional stunt. It was actually...
How annoying.
You know what? I'll tell you, I can imagine it's fun, and you can, of course, switch it off, but it's fun for like the first half hour, but then when you're stuck in traffic and you constantly hear Arnold Schwarzenegger say, "Turn right, I insist."
Oh, God. Or, he had to really record a lot, or did he not do a full spectrum?
He did, actually. In a quarter mile, turn left.
That's a lot of recording. I wonder how long it takes to set up all the words and phrases they need to do a full guide. That's interesting.
I have no idea, but so what I love is when he says, "Hazard ahead, get down!"
Okay, so this is the fifth Terminator film. The first two were smash hits. The last three, if this one turns out to be a flop, and we'll wait to see where it ends up, but it's not looking great. The last three have been flops, and they still have two more planned. I mean, the Christian Bale was a flop. The third in the original trilogy was a flop. This one doesn't look good. So they still have two more planned. I can't imagine they're going to go through with that.
Well, Arnold Schwarzenegger, I keep saying Arnold Schwarzenegger today. I don't know why. Maybe I just want to say long names. I don't know. But when he was at CinemaCon, he came out on stage and he said, this will be the fifth film. He said, we don't count the fourth one, though, you know, because and now he may be saying in that fifth
we
one.
We won't be counting the fifth one either.
Exactly.
Yeah. And number two around the world is Jurassic World, a huge success story. Another $72 million. It's made $1.385 billion worldwide. It's one of the highest grossing films in North America, the highest grossing films worldwide. It's a monster smash. And again, I don't think anybody really cares. I don't think anybody has come out of Jurassic World saying, what a great movie. It's kind of weird to have a film be this successful. And I haven't met anyone who says, hey, I mean, kids, I'm talking to teenagers and kids and young. Everybody's like, yeah, it's pretty good. You know,
yeah. You know, Chris Pratt. The thing.
They like the movie. At most, they say it's pretty good. And yet it's a massive, massive success. Is it just because of bandwidth? They knew the name, they knew the film, they were ready to see dinosaurs, and everyone who wanted to see it could.
Well, speaking of bandwidth, I don't know, but you're a little choppy. So for our listeners, Michael is he is traveling. So, but you know, we'll power through. I don't know what the answer to your question is, Michael, but I will say this: I have been wondering. It's almost like mediocrity has won out in Hollywood, and we're just like willing to accept it now. You know, you throw a bunch of CGI on the screen, and you know, have a dinosaur eat something, and hey, we'll show up.
It was always thus. Junkie movies always made lots of money. Transformers has been a $1 billion franchise. God knows why. Those are bad movies. But I think the fans were actually...
How could you say that about Trent? That is one of the best franchises to me.
But fans seemed really excited by it, you know, as opposed to this movie where nobody seems excited by it. Anyway, people are looking forward to Minions. That's the number three movie around the world. Another $54 million. It hasn't opened up in North America yet, but it's... made $125 million in just a few territories, about 26. So it's got a lot of territory to go. It's doing well, and it opens this weekend or next weekend.
It opens soon
in North America. At number four is Inside Out, another animated film. $48 million over the weekend, $360 million and counting. It needs to get to $500 million in order to be profitable, and it will get there. Certainly one of the best reviewed movies of the year, and the first one that we can wholeheartedly endorse.
Well, and it's still making money here in North America. It made $30 million over the weekend.
Oh no, it's going to have great legs. It's a family film, great reviews. People are loving it. It's a success on every level. It beat
Terminator Genesis here in North America.
Well, yeah, it did, but it did. I think it beat Jurassic World in the 5-day total, but not in the 3-day total. So, if you count from Wednesday, I believe Inside Out won, but if you count from Friday to Sunday, Jurassic World was the champion. Because here in North America, Terminator Genesis and Mad Max underperformed. The number one movie in North America is Jurassic World, followed by a smidge Inside Out. That's over the 3-day weekend. So there you go. Those two movies remained on top despite two new movies with a lot of traction and interest to them. They did not manage to dethrone those guys. And number five around the world is Monk Comes Down the Mountain. A $28 million weekend, $35 million overall. It's a Chinese comedy fantasy directed by Chen Cage. If I'm pronouncing his name right, he, of course, was the director behind Farewell, My Concubine.
Well, I'll tell you, if it's a Tibetan monk, and it certainly is a fantasy, Chinese fantasy. It's a Tibetan monk joke.
Wow, you're making fun of oppression of people.
No, well, I'm not.
And number six around the world is Ted 2, the foul-mouthed teddy bear. Another $20 million. That's about to hit $100 million worldwide, and a lot of territories to go for that one. It cost about $70 million to make. It needs to make about $200 million in order to be profitable. Here's another question about profitability. It's Magic Mike XXL. I actually saw this movie. Apparently, I'm the only man who did. This movie opened in North America and a few other territories. It made $18 million over the weekend. It's made $33 million since Wednesday. It only cost $15 million to make. The audience was 96% women.
Wait. 96%
women.
Just that I get this straight. 96% women, and yet women's soccer was on, so that means that it made all of its money Friday and Saturday night.
Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Not a lot of Saturday. And Sunday day, because the women's soccer was on Sunday night at 7. So I don't think that was a big conflict. But again, 96% women, proving, in fact, that gay men make up about 4% of the population, I guess.
Well, I will tell you that I went to the gym, and as I'm walking in, the people who check you in with the little cards, and they make sure that you've paid and all that. I heard them saying strippers, and I was like, wait, what? I said, and of course I had to make one of my lovely jokes, kind of like when I make fun of, you know, oppression. I said, wait, there are strippers? Where? What room? You know, just joking. They were like, oh, we're talking about Magic Mike. They were like so disappointed for me, like, no, not those kinds of strippers.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it would be good for guys to go see Magic Mike, because if you saw it, you'd want to start working out. You know, gym membership would in fact soar. They should just put it on a loop and every guy watching go, yeah, I gotta work out. So this movie cost $15 million to make. It doubled its budget on opening weekend worldwide. And everybody immediately said, aha, look, it's gonna be a big profitable success, blah, blah, blah. But clearly the $15 million budget does not include the back end for Channing Tatum and Steven Soderbergh.
You said back end while talking about Magic Mike.
Very nice. Well, but surely that they've got a piece of that. If they made it for $15 million, that means he's getting money off the top, right?
I would imagine you're right. Yes, I would think
they didn't do it for love. They didn't make Magic Mike XXL because it was a passion project born out of their heart. They did it to make money.
Well, certainly Warner Brothers did. I don't necessarily know what their deals were.
No, of course you don't. But I'm just assuming that $15 million budget has an asterisk. I mean, clearly it's a movie they wanted to make for a dime and wanted to make. They had fun doing it. So they, you know, but clearly they're going to expect some money if it makes a lot. Just like the first one did.
Well, and Channing Tatum, who is the star of both films, if I'm not mistaken, when he signed the first contract, it no doubt had an automatic clause for, oh, by the way, in case.
Oh, I doubt that as such.
Well,
I mean, whatever was in the first contract for a movie that cost $7 million to make, I don't think they had him locked in for 3 sequels. And if they did, when the first movie was a hit, he has the power to say, excuse me, but this is what we're going to do for the sequel. So, you know, you can't lock him in at that stage for a movie at that budget. I don't think you can expect draconian contract deals. Can you?
Oh, they're all, it's almost
they were
standard
happy to have
now.
Them. I know it's standard, but it's meaningless for a star of that and for a movie that costs $7 million to make. I don't. It's not like you're locking him in for Spider-Man. It's Magic Mike.
Yeah, well, and that's why it, in a way it's like, yeah, sure, fine. I'll sign on for a sequel. What's the big deal? And what winds up happening in these instances where a movie,
they always renegotiate.
They either A, renegotiate, or B, they renegotiate after some contention, and that contention is usually like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm just not available. I have other films that have to go before Magic Mike XXL, but I'll definitely do it since I'm contracted to do it. I'll definitely do it when I have time. And the reality is that unless you lock someone like Channing Tatum down, then all the other parts can't actually fall into place, so they wind up paying a little extra above the contracted amount, just because there's no way to
That's how Hollywood works.
Yes, exactly.
Course. Yes, yeah. But it's a $15 million budget. I'm sure he got more than he did for the first one. They had fun. I saw it. It's like the Apocalypse Now for male strippers. I mean, this is a surreal road trip movie. It is weird. It is the improv is so discursive and off to this. It's crazy. I thought I was on acid while I watched this movie, and it's better than the first. And number 8 is Spy, the Melissa McCarthy film. That's at $210 million worldwide. At number 9 and 10, $8 million, $7 million each, is NLL, the Korean film about the conflict between North and South Korea, and Avengers Age of Ultron. Obviously, a massive success story there. That's just been passed up by Jurassic World. And again, I don't know a lot of people who were happy about Age of Ultron either, actually. Some new movies down at the bottom. Le Profs 2, a French comedy starring the ginger-haired comedian Kev Adams, which does not sound like a French name, but apparently it is. That made $6.8 million in its opening weekend. And I Am Somebody, which is not the Jesse Jackson story, but another Chinese comedy. That grossed $4.2 million over the weekend and $6 million total. This is a kind of a fun one. This is a Chinese comedy set in a movie studio lot. I forget the name of it, but it's like the biggest lot in the world, apparently. It's out in the middle of nowhere, and lots of movies get made. And this is the story of like some bumbling extras who try to break into the biz. And I wanted to figure out what this movie was about because I didn't know, and I'm looking it up online, and I'm trying to find the trailer. And instead, what did I find? The movie. Oops.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm reading right now this book, and I think, Michael, I don't know if you're reading it, but I know that you know about it, How Music Got Free.
No, I haven't read it yet, yeah.
And it's fascinating, you know, basically the whole piracy issue in the music industry. And I know we're talking about the movie industry, but it's a bit of an issue, I guess, for anything having to do with entertainment these days.
Anything digital.
Yes.
That's right. So there was a note about Jurassic World. In Variety, it said in China, the Jurassic World took in grosses of $9.3 million in the fourth and final week of release for the movie for a 24-day total of $223 million. I sort of missed that. Do they have like, all right, you've had 4 weeks, you're gone?
Oh, absolutely. Especially if you're, you know, if you have a very popular movie. In this case, there's a little bit of a co-production, I think, maybe going on. I could be wrong about that. But, you know, they will basically...
That's not the magic bullet it used to be, I'm sure.
Yeah, they basically will say, I'm sorry, but your window is now closed. Or they'll close the window early because you're too popular and they have Chinese films, you know, domestic films coming out. Yeah, they absolutely have a window of when it opens and when it closes.
So here in North America, in indie film information, Love and Mercy crossed the $10 million mark domestically. This is a film starring Paul Dano and John Cusack. It's about Brian Wilson and the creation of Pet Sounds. Is it Pet Sounds and Smile? I think it goes back and forth. But this is a movie I've been hearing a lot of from friends. They really like this movie, especially Paul Dano's performance. Me and Earl and the Dying Girl expanded a bit, moved into the top 10. That's made $4 million and counting, whereas Dope has made $15 million because it opened wide. Who turned out to be smarter with those two little indie films that are geared towards young people? We'll have to wait and see. And finally, a documentary film, Amy. This is the film about Amy Winehouse that Sperling has seen and loved. This was a huge success story. It opened on 6 screens. It made $37,000 per screen on average. That's one of the best per screen averages ever for a documentary film. They're opening it wide next week. I don't know what wide means, but it's going to be wider. So we'll have to see where that ends up.
Well, I can tell you, Amy's great. I saw Dope. That's also very good. I think Open Road paid $7 million for that. I could be wrong about this figure.
I think that's about right. $6 million, something like that, yeah.
And figure, you know, they'll wind up breaking even on that one, it looks like.
Mm-hmm. And opening this week in North America is Minions, that is true, and The Gallows, which is a cheapy horror flick, and Selfless, which is a film directed by Tarsem Singh. He used to be a hot commodity in movies.
Tarsem, that's right, Tarsem.
He had big visual flair. He's sort of fallen on hard times. This movie stars Ryan Reynolds and Ben Kingsley. It doesn't look promising.
No, it does not look promising at all. And it's getting even worse reviews.
Oh, has it gotten reviews? I haven't seen them yet. But the following week is Ant-Man. This is the final film we'll talk about. I wanted to Ant-Man. I don't know what's going on here, but I know a lot of people who go see every Marvel movie. They people who went to see Terminator Genesis. They see everything. And without me asking them, they're all like, yeah, I don't want to see Ant-Man. They're all like, yeah, I don't want to go.
The only way this film can do well is, in my opinion, and I could be wrong about this because I'm a little shaky on the whole comic book thing, but this movie has to cross over and get really good reviews for people like me to go, yeah, I'm going to go see that movie. But because otherwise... I mean, I have no interest in seeing this movie at all.
Well, I like Paul Rudd a lot. And every time I mention that, people go, yeah, I like Paul Rudd. But they just, there's Ant-Man's not a cool comic. But they had the same problem with Iron Man. They were predicting last week like a $60 million opening weekend for Ant-Man. There have been, you know, Marvel flops in this Marvel universe that they've created. You know, the Incredible Hulk didn't do well. The original Thor did not make money. You know, they've had a couple stumbles. So we'll have to see where this goes. This could be, you know, another stumble for Marvel. We'll have to see. But I've been surprised at the resistance from people to this movie maybe they're getting sick of them. It just feels like Overlord and Ant-Man is not the one. But yeah, like you say, if it gets good reviews and people say Paul Rudd is hilarious and fun, you know, maybe they'll turn it around.
Well, now I also noticed that you have this note here that the Minions budget is actually $85 million. That is the correct budget? Is that what...
Well, that's I saw one report of the budget. Okay. Again, it's not like the where they quoted the producer on record, but either Billboard or Variety said, yes, the budget is about $85 million. So that movie is going to tear it up. It'll make easily, you know, $500 million or more, no matter what.
Yes, and the irony is nobody actually speaks the language of the main characters.
Okay.
Well, because they speak in the... Oh, never mind.
So we've talked a lot about box office around the world. Let's focus in on the box office in China versus India, because we've got a lot of info on those two countries. This is sort of our big story this week. We're looking at two markets that are huge. They have a billion people each, more than a billion people. They're very successful with their own films. You know, the people go to see their films a lot. And there are growing markets for North America. But really, China is far outpacing India. Maybe it's because India does not have the same growing middle class as strongly. I mean, India is a very vibrant country economically, but maybe China is just outpacing it in that regard. But it's a kind of an interesting contrast. So like when you look at China and India, how much of the Chinese market do U.S. films account for?
I think over 50%. Well, it is over 50% because once the box office for the 34 films that they allow in reaches 50%, somehow the Chinese government and the China Film Group, they start making rules like, oh, I'm sorry, you can't open, you have to open up against each other, or they'll like try
That's
and
right,
like,
yeah, say enough.
Yeah. So right now it's at 50% in China. So all the Hollywood big blockbusters have made 50% of the box office in China. So now what is 50% of the box office? What has Chinese, that China has
well,
made.
Well, as NATO tried to make clear, they said, all right, don't get too excited by China, because yes, I think U.S. films last year generated about $2 billion. And they say, well, yeah, since you get to take out about 25% of that, you're only getting $500 million, as opposed to North America, where the box office is $10 billion and the studios are pulling back $5 billion. So compare $500 million to $5 billion, and you can see why the U.S. is still a much more important market financially to North America studios.
Right, but I guess the studios and the entire industry is basically playing off the, well, eventually they'll have to cave and let more films in and let us take home more. Right now, there's $3.3 billion in ticket sales for the first 6 months of 2015 in China. Okay, so that's...
And it's grew by like another huge amount, 38% over last year
no,
or something. It
has surged 50%. And this
wow.
is, according to the consulting firm Artisan Gateway, 48.9% over the first half of 2014. So
right, so 50% of 6 or 7 billion is a lot better than 50% of 3 billion,
right,
which is what we were looking at just a few years ago. Now in India, and I shouldn't put you on the spot like this, but in India, U.S. films account for about 10% of the total. And I don't know why that is. Is that due to local preference? Is it due to government control over the market like China does? Do you know the reason for that?
Well, a couple things. One, the ticket price is much, much lower in India. So let's start.
No, but it's the percentage.
Okay,
it's the
percentage.
Okay, it doesn't matter what the ticket price is. U.S. films only account for 10% of the total. Whatever that total is, it's only 10%. So why aren't U.S. films more popular?
It's cultural preference. So it's local preference, number one. And number two, it's also a bit of a piracy issue. The films in India get pirated a lot more readily. And so,
do they not pirate Indian films?
And Indian films as well. So it doesn't matter.
Right, but they would affect them the same, I would imagine.
Yes. You know,
films are popular. So again, that doesn't explain why they're just 10%. So there's no government controls, no restrictions, no nothing. It's just
there are a few restrictions, absolutely, but not nearly as strict as China. But really, you're looking at a $1.5 billion box office, right? And so effectively, the studios are thinking, okay, not only is it harder for us to release a film there, for a number of reasons.
Why is it harder?
Not the least of which is the cultural reason, trying to get their films, basically people wanting to see their films.
They want to see their own movies. Yeah.
Right. But at the same time, we don't even make that much money there.
Right. So if the box office is $1.5 billion and U.S. accounts for about 10%, that means they're generating $150 million in China last year. And what percentage did they get?
Probably
like
30%. You mean in India?
I mean in India. And they only probably get like what, 25%, 30%? What's their cut of the India box office?
Who knows? I mean,
it's certainly not 50% like it is in North America.
No, and I can tell you that even the Indian producers, they call them producers, not distributors. They are always fighting with the exhibitors over how much, what the percentage is. So even domestic productions are fighting to get a bigger cut of the box office, which, you know, if you're starting with domestic productions not getting a big cut of the box office, you can only imagine what imported ones are doing.
Especially if they're less popular. So to recap, China is growing by leaps and bounds. It's a $6 to $7 billion market this year. U.S. generates about half of that, $3 billion they're hoping for this year, which means if they get 25% of that, they're going to be talking...
close to $1 billion, basically.
Well, not a billion, more like 700 million, right?
I mean, okay, fine.
3 billion, yeah. So about $700 million. In India, they'll be pulling home about 30 million, 40
yeah,
million.
Exactly. You can see why
and
the focus.
Both markets are a billion people, so there's a lot of work to do in India. What has to happen? What has to change there? The average ticket price in China is $6, but it's trending down. Listen to that, North America, and there's lots of reasons. People buy tickets in group sales. They have online services offering discounts. I wish that came to America. In India, the average ticket price for regular theaters is about $2. They have some premium theaters for $4. So I'm going to guess their ticket price is somewhere around $3.
Well, and I should point out, Patrick Von Sikofsky over at Celluloid Junkie, and yes, I know that's a personal plug, but he basically wrote a great article, a great post on these discount services.
You'll have to link to it. It's not in our show notes yet.
Yeah, I should have, because as I was doing the show notes this week, I kind of thought of that piece and thought, oh, that's interesting. Patrick was already talking about these because basically the discount companies are losing money selling tickets, and they're all like, you know, mobile apps and things like that. But
do they make money on advertising, or what's the game plan?
I have no idea. I couldn't figure it out myself, and I think it's
their goal is to sell it off to Amazon and cash in.
I have never,
you don't
Alibaba
have to actually make money.
Yeah, it makes no sense at all. But I guess where you were headed with this whole thing is, you know, while the Chinese average ticket price is around $6 and falling, the average Indian ticket price, the average, you know, movie ticket price in India is about $2 for a multiplex. And multiplexing in India and even in China is kind of a new thing. So they're already pretty nice as far as the multiplexes go. So that's kind of a, let's call that middle income venue. But the high end venues, the, you know, luxury venues, they're $4.
Right, so we don't have an official average. We're going to guess it's somewhere around $3, probably a little bit lower than that, since I imagine most sales occur in the multiplexes.
Yeah, I would go with that as well.
The one bright spot in India is that a big marker for a hit film, like in North America, that used to be $100 million. Now you make that in a weekend. But in India, a marker for a really big hit film is 1 billion rupee total. That's about $16 million. If you've made $16 million in India, you are a big success story. Before this year, only one American film hit the 1 billion rupee mark. That's Avatar. That's it. This year, both Fast and Furious 7 and Jurassic World have done it already. So they're starting to gain some traction, perhaps, in India. But there's a lot of work to do.
Well, Michael, that's a good point, actually, that both you said Jurassic World and Fast and Furious 7 have made that. Okay.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
There's a couple points to be made here. You wonder why Hollywood keeps making these blockbusters. So you look at what happened in India with those two films, and then you go over to China and you look at the big box office successes there, and it's Fast and Furious 7, Avengers Age of Ultron, Jurassic World. It's these big blockbuster sequels.
Those are the three highest grossing movies in China this year. And of course, there would be more, except there's all those restrictions. But
that's right.
Five of the top 10 movies on the Chinese chart for so far this year are American films.
Now,
Furious 7 with almost $400 million, Avengers 2 with $230, and Jurassic World with $200 million. The first Chinese film to do it is The Man from Macau 2, which grossed $150 million.
Now, I also want to point out, and this gets a little geeky and a little insidery, but...
That's never stopped you before.
No, but, you know, this time I thought I'd at least warn people. You know, it's kind of like a PG-13 warning,
okay.
Which we'll get to in a moment, actually. In India, Fast and Furious 7 and Jurassic World are Universal films. They were released both on digital cinema, and Universal decided to get a wider release. They would do what's called e-cinema. So it's not
high quality?
Yes, as far as, you know.
It's crappier quality.
Instead of 2K, it's like, you know, basically HD.
Why would they do that? Because it gets into a lot more towns than hamlets quicker?
correct, and they're trying to beat piracy. They're trying to say, well, okay, you know what? If it gets to these smaller towns and smaller venues where they can't afford digital cinema equipment, where they only have e-cinema equipment, and they can see it legitimately, maybe people will do that and go see it legitimately. However, you know, all the studios and DCI and the industry has spent, you know, the last 15 years coming up with all of these protections and all of these standards to protect the films and to make sure that what is being shown is of a quality, you know, is shown perfectly and in pristine condition, that a lot of the other studios are very upset with Universal for kind of backing down a bit and saying, yeah, okay, we'll do this e-cinema thing, but only in this territory, because it's kind of like a slippery slope. I mean, once you, and speaking of dope, which where the word slippery slope plays a key plot point, this is a slippery slope, because if you allow it in India, then you're going to have other countries saying, well, how come you can't allow it here?
How many countries want it?
Well, nobody knew that it was even a possibility until recently.
Who wants
recently.
It? Who's saying we want crappy cinema? What country is demanding that they be able to show pictures in inferior quality? Who is calling for this? Well, are they calling for that in Japan? Are they calling for it in England, France, Germany, Spain,
Nigeria,
Russia?
Nigeria.
Well, Africa, and Africa is a continent that is completely underexploited by Hollywood and ravaged by piracy. So maybe that makes sense. You know, I love great picture quality, but if you're getting ripped off and you're saying, well, we're not going to show it in that Hamlet, even though they can't afford the equipment, we refuse to show it, and therefore the people pirate it, who's to blame? You know, people want a digital album, give them the chance to buy a digital album. If you force them to steal it, they will.
Well,
and that's what they're doing right now. They're forcing people to steal. They won't let them show the movies. They can't afford equipment. And so the only option they have is to show it in e-cinema. Well, let them do it.
Well, and I should point out, in some of these theaters, the e-cinema is actually of the same quality. And because they're smaller, so
yeah,
therefore,
oh God,
you know,
nobody's going to call us. How dare you downgrade? How dare you just, you know, disdain e-cinema? It's lower cost, cheaper. It's usually not up to the same technical standards. It's okay. It's not as good as, you know, DCP or whatever, right?
Right. In most instances, that is correct.
It ain't going to have Dolby Atmos.
No, it's not going
to. This is clearly an inferior exhibition choice, but that's the option that you have in rural India where, you know, people starving to death and you're angry they don't have, you know, six-figure, you know, digital projection screens. You know, India and Africa are wildly underserved. If that's what they should do, they should do it. Good for Universal.
Well,
I think it's a big deal. You know, the box office so far in India is just kind of a big whoop. It's not that big. China is a big deal and it's growing. But if e-cinema is the way to reach people who otherwise will be forced to pirate your movie, then that's what you should embrace.
Well, before we move on to another segment, popular copyrighted segment, I should say, of our show here. Do you think it's a big deal that Gaspar Noé's Love, which is to say that it's not pornographic, is questionable, but it got...
Why? What's your definition of porn? To me, the definition of porn is something whose only purpose is to you know, show people having sex to turn you on.
Okay, well then maybe this isn't a pornographic film, but it certainly contains some of the same content.
It's explicit.
Yes.
It's people having sex.
And this is Gaspar Noé's Love. We talked about it. It showed in Cannes, and we talked about it when it showed there. What do you think? It got a 16 rating, not an 18 rating?
In France, the government ruled that the film would not be banned to people under 18, that they would allow people 16 and over to see it. They're French. Yeah. Of course. They say the people are making the love. So what?
Okay. Well, we talked about China. We now talked about France. Do we want to let people know that in the UK, Minions is now the highest, it's the highest opening ever for an animated film?
We should have just told them at the top. I forgot.
Okay. Well,
the biggest, highest opening weekend for an animated film in history.
Well, listen, we told people that we take them all over the world talking about box office, which I think is a big deal.
Keep going.
Oh, okay. Well, then fine. I was trying to somehow segue us back into Big Deal or Big Whoop, which you did so well and then I ruined. But Big Deal or Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. This first story, I think, is probably a big deal. The rock band The Grateful Dead told audience members to please be kind, and that's a quote, and ended their 50-year career with a series of sold-out concerts in Chicago over the 4th of July weekend. True to form, they featured improvisational jams on stage, marijuana in the audience, and tapers. And these are The tapers are the men and women who record the live concerts with the blessing of the band. While the group has released countless albums, especially when you count box sets and all of their live shows, the heart of the Grateful Dead lay in touring, and the Deadheads who followed them from town to town, sometimes for years at a time. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop.
What?
It was kind of sweet to see front page, well, at least the front page of the website of the New York Times, a sold-out stadium, all the guys who were still alive getting together. But, you know, really, the final show with Jerry Garcia when he died unexpectedly was in Chicago on July 9th, 1995. It was unexpected. It was almost 20 years ago to the day of this final show. And that, to me, was the end of the Grateful Dead. So it's cool that these guys had their last hurrah. It's good that they're going out and gave the fans a chance to say goodbye. But you feel like the story was kind of really over 20 years ago.
I was a little surprised that the Grateful Dead were even still a band, frankly.
Oh, well, you know, they had stopped for a little bit and they called themselves something else for a little while, but they finally just embraced their legacy and said, oh, you know what? We're still here. Let's do it.
Yes, I believe they called themselves The Dead.
At one point, yeah.
The BBC announced it was firing some 1,000 employees in an attempt to save money, streamline, and so on. What prompted it? Perhaps the news a few days later that the BBC might be facing a $1 billion cut in its budget. Up to now, other branches of the government have paid for the TV license fee of the elderly. The TV license is the crucial main source of income for funding the BBC. Now that cost may be shifted to, well, the BBC itself. So imagine someone paying you $100,000 a year and then announcing you'll have to start paying yourself that same $100,000 each year. Not such good news, but is it a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal because the BBC is an institution. It provides such great programming and service to the BBC and the world, frankly, with their radio and their international news coverage. It's a real shame. One thing that they were thrown a bone was that they may be allowed to charge for their video on demand service. It's called iPlayer. It's really popular and it's free right now. iPlayer might bring in $250 million a year, so $1 billion, they'll be short about $750 million. So that's going to be a really devastating blow to the BBC, and that means a devastating blow to people who enjoy quality TV and news around the world.
That's like saying, you know, oh, can I move into that $1 million house? Well, let's see, with my salary minus taxes, I make, I'm still $950,000 short.
Exactly.
No, I can't. Scribd is one of the early innovators offering book subscriptions, the same way Netflix and Spotify offer subscriptions for movies and TV or music. The problem? People were reading a lot. They've decided to cut way back on romance titles because so many readers were devouring so many books in that genre that they were reading Scribd out of house and home, almost literally. After a certain amount of a book is read, Scribd makes its payment to the publishers. And the number of romance titles being read was simply unsustainable, an issue that hasn't arisen with other genres like mystery and sci-fi. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal, I think. It's hard to tell. I mean, you know, they're trying to adjust and reflect the reality of what's happening when people get, you know, access to a bunch of books like this. And of course, the early adopters are always going to be the heavy users. They're going to be the people who pay a ton of money, who want to read a ton of books and are willing to do something like this. So right now they charge $9 a month. I don't know. Maybe they should have a tier for heavy users. That's $18 a month. Why try to be one size fits all? There aren't enough people subscribing yet to make it work. They're, of course, hoping for the gym model, which means a lot of people subscribe to ebook subscription service, and most of them don't read that many books, just like most people don't go to the gym. So you can afford to have a gym space and have 1,000 people subscribe because only 40 show up at a time. So I don't know. These are early adopters. I have never felt like book subscriptions make sense. This is the opposite problem of what I thought people had. Why pay $10 a month for a book service when most people don't read one book a month? In this case, you've got the people who are reading 4, 5, 6, 8 books a month, and they're just, you know, punishing the company with their heavy use.
Just days after ballet star Misty Copeland made headlines by becoming the first African-American woman to be named a principal dancer at the ABT, that's the American Ballet Theater, she's doing it again. Now Copeland has made headlines for announcing her Broadway debut. She'll be stepping into a lead role in the revival of On the Town, taking the place of another dancer who has a planned break. I thought that was like a plan, like I'm going to break my leg, but I'm going to break it right here. But no, it's,
no.
She's actually on vacation. In fact, Copeland is taking over from Megan Fairchild, another principal dancer at the ABT, and the sister of Robert Fairchild, who is also performing on Broadway in the new musical, An American in Paris. Is all this plie-ing a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. I can't even understand why their show is still open. It's grossing 35% of its potential box office. It's making like, it made like $600,000 last week. It might have broken even, might have, I say. The week before, I don't think it did. So this is really, you know, $630,000 for a big musical with a lot of dancers and a pretty big size orchestra. It's likely that their budget is at their nut, I should say. Their weekly operating cost has to be over $700,000. They've been losing money for weeks and weeks and weeks and months. And months and months. Why are they going to be open in August? I just don't get it.
So that Misty Copeland can come and, you know, do her thing.
Yeah, I guess that they're being nice.
Things do happen faster these days. The fallout from Donald Trump's wildly racist comments about Mexicans keeps on coming. Macy's, the department store, is the latest to cut ties with the billionaire presidential candidate. Meanwhile, the rebel flag controversy spreads throughout the entertainment world. Last week, we mentioned Warner Brothers had stopped selling memorabilia from the TV show The Dukes of Hazzard involving the car the General Lee, which has the rebel flag emblazoned on its roof. Now, reruns of the comic series, they have been yanked.
It ain't a drama.
Yeah, that's true. The biggest flag maker in the U.S. will stop making the rebel flag, which is considered racist by many, if not everybody. Happy news to its predominantly black employees, by the way. Yeah, great. And now NASCAR is asking fans not to display the symbol of hate at NASCAR events. That didn't work out too well over the weekend. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I know, but it's amazing that NASCAR would ask that. That really is a sign of the times. When NASCAR is turning its back on this symbol, you know things have changed. It didn't work well, I guess, at the race over the weekend. They were showing it everywhere. What happened?
Yeah, that didn't work well. And, you know, people...
Well, what do you mean? People showed up. They didn't say they were going to ban it, but they said, we'll give you an American flag in substitute. Please don't bring it. They've made the official distancing. People did it in rebellion. But now, you know, next week, the weekend after, people may be less likely to do it.
Right.
They're saying, hey, we don't want this around. People angrily said, don't tell us what to do.
Right.
But the fact that NASCAR would even step out and feel like they could say that, that is a big change. And Donald Trump, things aren't over for him. I just saw an article in a golf... I wanted to say magazine, but it's an online newsletter sort of thing called Global Golf Post. It's really good.
No, now and the PGA is distancing itself from him because he owns all these golf clubs.
Well, they are. Yeah, he owns tons of golf, but they're saying, hey, you need to cut ties with him completely. They're saying, don't bring your events to his clubs. Don't give him money. And as soon as he sees it's not working, he'll back out and liquidate his share of the ownership and move on. They're saying, you know, you shouldn't do business with him. So we'll have to see where that ends up as well.
I mean, this may be one of the worst things Donald Trump has done, like decision-wise, one of the worst decisions he's ever made.
What, to run for president?
Yeah, well, and then, of course, in doing
so... Well, he's made stupid comments like that before, so...
Yeah, but not as a potential presidential candidate. Well, not even a potential presidential candidate. He is a presidential candidate now.
That's right.
Well, anyway, speaking of politics.
And by the way, why did Reels pick it up? This is cable channel Reels picked up the Miss USA pageant that airs on July 15th. Univision backed out. NBC backed out. Donald Trump is suing both of them. Reels doesn't even reach most of the country. They only reach 60% of the country. And they said, yeah, we'll take it. I'm like, what? You don't like Hispanic and Latino people?
I think right now they'd like any people watching their network. That's their problem.
So. Yeah. I guess so.
Now, speaking of politics, the EU is fully embracing net neutrality. New rules that go into effect next April may prove a big boost for over-the-top services. Of course, one of the big bottlenecks for people switching to OTT offerings like numerous TV packages might be the cost of internet access. With cable providers losing out on your monthly cable bill, they may decide to bump up your monthly internet bill. But the EU is clamping down on anyone who wants to try and piggyback on Netflix and the like with strict guidelines about what they can charge and to avoid companies favoring one service over the other. That way, the next YouTube or Netflix can have a fighting chance. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal because it's essential if you want OTT to take off. And we're going to have to see the same sort of oversight in North America because if you don't, they're going to favor big companies that can pay the highway toll. And that's going to make everybody else suffer. That's why we have the worst internet coverage in the developed world.
Well, I actually heard an interview with Tom Wheeler over the weekend. We're actually on Friday, and he was talking about this very issue and how they are monitoring.
Thank you for clarifying that was Friday, not the weekend, because if you had said the weekend and it turned out you'd heard it on Friday, we would have raked you over the coals.
Well, you know, if somebody went searching for Tom Wheeler interview Saturday, you know, they wouldn't get it, whereas it was on Marketplace on Friday.
You might have played it online digitally later, but anyway, yeah. I'm just kidding. What did he say?
he said that they're looking out for it, that they're kind of monitoring this to make sure that these types of things don't happen where they're, you know, preferential zero rating type of activity. But I love this next story. I know, you know, net neutrality can be kind of boring and dry for our
listeners.
You
love it. I love it.
Okay. Well, this next story is about director Peter Jackson, who just can't leave Middle Earth. We have tried reaching him there and tried to send him a map so that he could find his way out. But after making 6 films in that world, he's had a livable space based on Bilbo's home at Bag End recreated in his basement in New Zealand. It may be the first time guests would want to stay in the basement of his mansion. Big deal or big whoop?
Oh, God. This is a big whoop, of course. But apparently, like, Spielberg and Lucas have been invited and they've been allowed to stay there or play. I mean, I would just love to check it out. I'd love to have been on the set, but, like, in your home, that is so geeky. I love it. That's just, you know, he had the people who built the set come in there and they're like, yeah, we had to get it right. Trust me, because he knew. but it's like a livable apartment down there. That's just as super cool as it gets if you're a total geek.
Well, Steven Spielberg said, look, I'm short, but this is ridiculous. Because, you know, they're hobbits. See, they're tiny.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Well, Michael, I read this next story that we're about to talk about, and I thought, I wonder if Michael's heard of this book, because speaking of fantasy and sci-fi, the movie studio Fox has jumped into a deal with debut novelist Stephanie Garber. Her first book, Heart Made of Black, is a young adult novel set in a unique world with the story revolving around two sisters. It doesn't even have a publication date yet, but Fox has already snagged film rights for the book and its sequel. See what I'm talking about there? You see that? The sequel thing that we were talking about? Anyway, that comes after the two-book series was the focus of a bidding war, with the imprint Flatiron winning out. It's also been purchased by Hodder in the UK for a 6-figure deal. I wonder if we could actually talk to Ms. Garber about borrowing some money. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. I mean, these things happen all the time. Obviously, after Harry Potter and then The Hunger Games, young adult novels and kids' books, which were always a source of movies and TV stuff, became a really hot properties because they have really high concepts, usually 2 or 3 movies, built into the story because they have 2 or 3 books, in this case, 2 books, or in the case of Harry Potter, 7, God bless her, and, really strong storytelling. So it's just perfectly made for Hollywood. So, I mean, that's nothing new. It's been going on since movies began, but certainly Harry Potter kicked it into a new higher gear because young adult novels have proven so popular with adults. It helps to have a couple million people read your book before you make the movie. But in this case, you know, it happens. The Bone Season just a few years ago, that came out by Samantha Shannon, the first book in a 7-book series. That was optioned by Fox. It was a Today Show pick. And then really, it didn't do very well. So you never know. You know, these things happen. There's a big literary fiction book coming out in the fall called City on Fire by Garth Risk-Hallberg. And that was the big title. And lots of publishers were fighting to release that book. It's like an 800-page novel about New York City in the 70s. And the early reviews have not been great. So I'm sure they're not thrilled about that. But that's what happens. You know, you want to get attention for a book.
Have there been more than one review for that book? Because I read one review, but I can't find any
other. Well,
there's
Publishers Weekly, and there are some early reviews online by readers.
Okay.
You know, you certainly don't want a 3-star average on Amazon out of 15 people, because anything less than 4 stars out of 5 means people were very mixed on it. It's very unusual to see almost any book that has any sort of following get lower than 4 stars. 3.5 is problematic. 3 is trouble. This book has 3 stars. And the review from Publishers Weekly, which was the first one out, was not great. So that's no fun for them, but there's a long way to go. It hasn't come out yet. They haven't published it yet. I've got a copy, but I haven't read it yet. So, it's always a roll of the dice. But one way to make sure people at least know the book is coming out is to pay a lot for it at auction, 300,000 books come out a year in North America. We all know the name of City on Fire, and now we all know the name of Heart Made of Black. So they're one step up on the competition.
Speaking of one step up on the competition, and we have to thank CJ Flynn of DCinema Tools for this next story. It hadn't caught our eye yet, and it's about HBO's new over-the-top service. Because is HBO now a hit? Yes, it is. But how big a hit? We don't know, according to the analytics firm App Annie. Well, it's an analytics firm, App Annie. HBO Now was the highest grossing app on the iTunes App Store in May. Other apps might have been downloaded more often, but HBO Now pulled in the most money, outscoring long-established apps like Spotify and Hulu. June estimates aren't out yet, but App Annie says that HBO Now continued to do well. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop.
No. Okay.
I mean, first of all, it launched in May, so how could it not be the number one app? If it wasn't, it would have been a nightmare of epic proportions. And we just don't know how many they've sold. You know, I'm not quite sure. I tried to figure out how App Annie does their analysis because they don't have figures from, you know, Apple, that's for damn sure. So I'm not quite sure how they figured it out that it was the highest grossing one. You know, I mean, maybe one that grossed sold for a dollar sold, you know, was downloaded 2 million times. You know, I don't know. So, you know, I don't know where they're getting their figures from. I wish we had strong, solid figures. This analysis is the best we got. No surprise that it's a hit, you know, opening month. It better be June, July, and August. If it's still the number one seller, then we'll be talking.
Well, and I wonder, and I probably should have looked this up, how one subscribes to HBO Now, because if it's through the app, traditionally, so in-app purchase.
They've got an exclusive deal with Apple. So that's one reason why they did it that way. If this is an exclusive deal and therefore that 30% cut off the top does not come into play, they've got some understanding and agreement because they said, hey, you can be the exclusive person, but you're not going to get 33%.
Right. Yeah. That's I thought maybe that's why when HBO decided to do this kind of streaming only subscription, they decided let's give Apple an exclusive.
Now, it's a window. It's a window, right? An exclusive window. They're not going to be the exclusive one forever.
Correct. Well, as a matter of fact, I think this month, actually, the 3-month exclusive period is over. And it will, you know, the HBO Now app will be coming to the Google Play Store and Android. So,
as always, I just wish we had more hard data. I hate having to estimate book sales when we don't know how many ebooks are sold on Amazon. You know, it's a pain in the neck.
Well, yeah, if we had hard data, that would be a big deal. But that does wrap up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, we do have some hard data, don't we?
Not really.
What?
Keep going.
Well, okay. I thought we had a mid-year roundup of music news. I mean, what are the best-selling albums of 2015 so far? Turns out, but Taylor Swift's 1989 is on top. Remember, I had that little cough at the beginning. Yeah, it sold the equivalent of 2 million copies.
Wait. Equivalent? Wait. This is what I hated. Billboard had a big story picked up by the LA Times and a lot of people talking about how Taylor Swift sold the equivalent of 2 million copies. What do you mean the equivalent? So Nielsen said, oh my God, we got all this streaming. We got all these video views. How can we, you know, hide the fact that album sales are collapsing? So the biggest album of the year so far is Taylor Swift's 1989. It came out in 2014, but that's not unusual. Albums often sell strongly for a year or two. I don't know why you thought that was a big deal. It's not. Adele's 21 sold a lot for a long time.
Yes,
but, anyway.
But most albums sell over 50, as I learned in How Music Got Free, they sell the bulk of their sales are in the first 4 weeks of release.
Well, that's because most albums don't sell. Of course that's true. That's a stupid stat. Most albums don't sell anything. So yes, for an artist that has no sales, but when you have a blockbuster album, it's very typical and often common for them to sell a lot week after week and month after month. Adele's album was the biggest album for like 2 or 3 years in a row. It's not unusual to sell, you know, that when you're a hit, you sell a lot. So yes, for most albums, which means the hundreds of thousands that disappear without a view, they sell only in their first 4 weeks, and it's to their mom and their best friend. Anyway, Taylor Swift's 1989 came out in October. Now in 2015, it has sold another 1.3 million copies. It's the only album to go platinum in 2015. Apparently, Billboard is ashamed of that or embarrassed by that because they want to do this equivalent thing. It's stupid. Tell us how much it's streamed. Tell us how many video views they have. Those are the new metrics you have. Trying to convert them into album sales is confusing, pointless, misleading, and wrong. I understand it's a new world. Streaming is now dominating, and you want to sort of try to capture that attention. We'll capture it by telling us how many times it's been streamed. I couldn't even figure out how they define streaming. Do you know? Is it if 10% of the album is played, 80%? Does the entire album have to be played before it counts as a stream? What if I play 4 tracks on day one and 8 tracks on day two? Is that 2 streams? 1 stream? I don't know.
Well, I think actually there is, and we covered this in the past.
Well, we know there's a formula, but
yeah,
I'm just
we
not
covered
clear
the
what
formula
it is
in
right
the past,
now.
And I think it was a certain number of plays equals an album sale. And
no, yes, it is, of course, but how do they define a single stream of an album? That's what I couldn't figure out. what does Nielsen consider a stream of Taylor Swift's 1989? If I go on and play 11 tracks.
Right, no. This is what we covered in the past, was how many plays of a track from that album it actually takes to get to that figure. We covered it in the past, and I'd have to look it up.
I think you're confusing different things. You know, because there's a lot of things going on here. You know, what constitutes a play of a song? What constitutes a full stream of an album? Clearly, if you play a song on the album 20 times, that counts as a stream of the song. I don't believe you have to play the entire album all the way through. So again, trying to somehow come up with a formula to pretend that's equal to an album sale is stupid. It's not an album sale. I understand people don't buy albums anymore, and you want to sort of hide that fact, but trying to create a new equivalency is dumb. You know, what you have is album sales and streams and video views. And we'll just have to get used to the fact that streaming and video views are a new thing. Right now, when they say some artist has 300 million views, I'm like, what? Wow. You know, it doesn't even mean anything. I can't convert it into how popular they are because I don't know what other artists are doing. It's not a number we're familiar with, but we'll get familiar. And trying to turn them into one big mushy number is not helping anybody. The simple fact is that Taylor Swift had the only album that sold over 1 million copies. Drake is almost there with If You're Reading This, It's Too Late. That's his best album in a while. And then you've got 3 or 4 albums that sold 700,000 copies. Sam Smith, Ed Sheeran, the soundtrack to 50 Shades of Grey, and poor Meghan Trainor.
Why is she poor?
Because she's got vocal rest. She's got she has been like dog and pony show all over the country. Her label has been killing her with personal appearances and concerts and events and things. She's been working like a dog, as if she's like a one-hit wonder instead of, you know, perhaps a career artist. And now she's paying the price vocally. She needs to learn how to say no, because clearly her manager or her label is not going to do it for her. But, you know, that's where we're at. Those albums have all sold about 700,000 copies. Kendrick Lamar, one of the best albums of this year, To Pimp a Butterfly, that sold 600,000 copies. That's good. But you know what? I went down to Billboard 200 to look at like sort of what albums are doing. They don't even list what albums have gone platinum or multi-platinum anymore. They don't bother because most albums are lucky to go gold. So they don't even show it anymore. It used to be you'd go on there and you'd see, you know, Born in the USA with an 8 by it, meaning it sold 8 million copies or 10 million copies. Now they don't even bother, even for the ones that have gone platinum. So, I mean, that's the world we're living now. They don't even bother to say when albums have gone gold because it's a rare event. And so it's kind of meaningless. You know, there's so few albums on the top 200 would be gold that they just can't be bothered to display it anymore. They feel like it's a useless statistic.
Okay, so here we go. Ready?
Uh-huh.
Digital album downloads plus digital track downloads, whereby 10...
Yeah, but that's those are sales.
Wait,
I'm talking about streams.
I'm going to do both.
Well, don't do it. We understand how downloads work. Don't confuse us with numbers. Just talk about streams.
Well, okay. But I think it's both because it's track equivalent album is called TEA. Stream equivalent album, or SEA, multiplies the number of streams at the current stream pay rate to equal the average blended wholesale revenue of $7.50.
Still don't know how they define it.
So in 2013, when the average blended payout for audio and video streams was approximately 0.00375 cents, or nearly 0.4 of a penny, 2,000 streams comprised one SEA unit. But this
they're saying once you've generated the same amount of money via streaming as you would have if you'd actually sold it, then it counts as a sale.
So 1,500 streams equal one album unit in 2014.
No.
Yes.
You're misreading that.
No, I'm reading it from Billboard. This is all from Billboard.
1,500 streams does not generate income to equal one album sale.
Well, okay.
That means Taylor Swift would have 40 million platinum. She'd have sold 40 million copies, not two. There's no hell. There's no freaking way 1,500 streams is equal to an album sale. That, I mean, you have tens of millions of streams. I mean, hundreds of millions.
Well, so let me finish. Last year, 2014, which is the year we have figures for, the per stream rate for audio and music videos is about 0.005. So it went up.
Whatever. It's meaningless. 0.005.
Well, think about it. 1,500 streams times half a penny,
But you haven't defined what a stream is. Is it 80% of the album, 50%, 30%, 20%? If I play four tracks one day and eight tracks the other, and that's still not all 18 tracks on Taylor Swift's album, what does that constitute? Do you add them all up and say each individual song counts as a stream of a song?
Yes.
What if I play one song 15,000 times and don't play any other tracks on the album? Does that count as an album stream?
Yes, it does. Yes.
If I play one single 1,500 times, that should only count towards the single, not towards the album.
And there's the rub. That's why everybody's so upset. Yes, you're absolutely right. It should. But instead, what it does is if you have played a track from that album, what did you say, 15,000 times?
Well, 1,500 times. You're saying 1,500 streams equals an album sale.
Yes. So then they would consider that, oh, you streamed, Blank Space, I think, is on 1989 or Shake It Off. They'd say, right, you streamed Shake It Off 1,500 times. That's one album sale for 1989.
Even though it should be more like five sales for the single or 10 sales for the single.
Correct.
So you're saying 1,500 streams is roughly equivalent to like $10 to buy an album. That's what
$7.50. And that is, by the way,
wholesale.
Yes, wholesale. That is, by the way, these are figures from last year. We don't have this year's figures. So sure, last year it was 1,500 streams. Maybe this year it'll be lower, higher. We don't know yet.
So she'd have to sell 700,000 copies times 1,500. What's that?
Well,
she sold 1.3 million copies. They said she had the equivalent of 2 million copies. I'm ignoring video and just assuming streaming. To get an extra 700,000 copies in equivalent sales, she'd have to stream it 1,500 times 700,000, because that's what you had to get to, right? So to equal 700,000 copies, you have to have 1,500 streams 700,000 times. So it has to be 15 times 70 million. So that means it's 300 million. You have to have like 300 million streams to equal 700,000 copies equivalent. You're saying 1,500 streams equals one album. Well, she sold the equivalent of 1,500 albums of 700,000 albums via streaming.
Yes.
Right? She jumped from 1.3 million to 2 million when you say equivalent. So that means she had the equivalent of 700,000 albums done via streaming. That means 700,000 times 1,500.
That would be 1,500,000,000, I think.
So she had 1,500,000,000 streams of her album.
I'm sorry, 1,050,000,000.
So 1 billion streams of her album in 6 months.
That's using this math, yes. If that math does hold out and that figure is even remotely correct, then you can see why she can turn around and tell Apple, you will be paying artists.
No, that you can see why album sales have collapsed.
Well, that's true too.
People aren't paying for anything. As opposed to singles, where people are actually finding it worth their while to pay a buck or $1.30 to get a song. The top selling single of the year so far is Mark Ronson's Uptown Funk with Bruno Mars. Almost 5 million copies actually sold so far.
Actually sold, none of the streaming stuff or track equivalent.
Ed Sheeran, 3.4 million copies of Thinking Out Loud. Wiz Khalifa with Charlie Puth, who I think is really talented. That song, See You Again, from the Fast and Furious 7 soundtrack, 3 million copies. Maroon 5, almost 3 million. Ellie Goulding, 2 million, blah, blah, blah. So, you know.
Wait, blah, blah, blah. Where are they on the charts?
Yeah. So,
The yes didn't make the charts at all.
It's so easy to buy a single, and the cost is so minimal. People still do that, even though they could stream it, I suppose, for free for a lot of them. Or they're just teenagers who want to play it over and over and over again, put it on their phone, and don't want to have to worry about it.
You know what? I'm just happy, okay? Sufjan Stevens sales have skyrocketed.
Sufjan.
You know what? The guy has sold 32,000 copies of his album. But you might think, that's not a lot. That's nothing. But it's on vinyl. He sold 32,000 on vinyl.
Well, you're spoiling my joke, because Taylor Swift also tops LP sales. And people have been saying, LPs are back. Vinyl is back. It's up almost 40% in 2015. This is the eighth consecutive year where vinyl has grown in sales. So clearly, I was wrong. Vinyl is not niche anymore. It's back, baby. But actually, when you look at the numbers, vinyl has sold a total of 5.6 million copies in 2015. The number one selling album on vinyl is Taylor Swift's 1989, and it sold a whopping 34,000 copies.
out
of 1.3 million.
Okay.
That's how many she sold when I got into streaming. So 34,000 copies is nothing, obviously. Clearly, vinyl is not coming back. It's still niche. On the other hand, Sufjan Stevens has sold 32,000 copies of his new album, Carrion Lowell, which is definitely one of the best albums of the year, albeit very depressing. All right, that's just a little bit lower than Taylor Swift, but it's a third of his entire sales. He's only sold 100,000 copies of his new album. So 33% of that comes on vinyl. Now you can see how vinyl is important to some artists. When you don't have a lot of sales and a lot of them come on vinyl, well, that's a very important revenue stream. You know, we look at 34,000 copies. That's about $3 million if you figure $15 an album, right? That's just not that much money. You know, even if sales double again next year, you're talking $6 million for the best-selling album on vinyl. That's still not a lot of money when you're talking about a business that's worth billions of dollars. So in the scheme of things, vinyl is not important. For certain independent acts like Sufjan Stevens, those sales really matter.
Well, and, you know, if you aren't buying albums and you're streaming your music or streaming your movies or your television shows and you live in Chicago, be prepared. You may have to pay an extra tax, which I think is this. I think will ultimately have to be shot down, because otherwise, if you're a business, this is unsustainable. If you're a Netflix or you're a Spotify or you're an Apple Music, what you're saying is within every zip code, you now have to look at what the taxes are and pay based on.
But it's just automatic. Well, that was the argument Amazon's. Well, we can't figure out the local tax. It's just a formula. You put it in once and it's done.
Yeah, but for every single zip code.
Well, it's rare that it's going to be in every zip code, but Chicago's done this for a long time. They have an entertainment tax or amusement tax, I guess. You bet there's a tax on going to the movies, seeing a play, seeing a concert, going to a basketball game. Why should online services be any different? If that's where people are spending their money and they want that income, they're going to have to tax you.
Yeah, it's going to be a nightmare. We'll see what happens with this one.
My accountant, I don't know what to do. Blah, blah, blah. Where will I put my billions?
There's the title of the show. Where will I put my billions?
But we're talking about streaming. Have you actually downloaded the new iTunes?
I did.
Have
and
you
I listened.
Played with Apple's music?
I have not actually signed up for the, because I'm a Spotify user.
Well, it's
user.
Free. It's a 3-month free offer just to see what it's like.
I haven't had time to do that. I have listened to Beats 1, which, have you listened to Beats 1?
I did once, and it was a really bad song, so I stopped.
Oh, my God. It's like, oh, I see what you've done. You've taken everything we hated about radio and put it into one place.
Why? What have they done? What specifically?
It's like listening to top 40 radio from the 1980s. You know, it's just like...
Well, now, there's multiple channels on the Apple radio. You mean like you were listening to what's his name in London? Or
yeah,
who were you listening
yeah,
to?
Yeah, just Beats 1, which is worldwide! I swear, it's like a dance channel. It's just the whole thing just turned me off so much. I was like, oh, look, you're IDing the station again. Oh, that's great. Okay. Well, oh, now you're talking over the song. Okay. You know, this is why we don't listen to radio anymore. Congratulations, Apple.
Well, I was excited by that. So I'll have to give it a better listen and different day parts and different, because there's a lot of different artists with different shows. So you may not have liked the show you liked, but the next show might be really cool.
Yeah, it just they were so up, and I was like, how much meth are you on right now?
Well, I've been playing with Apple Music. I've never dealt with Spotify or any other streaming service, and it's a little tempting, I have to say.
Yeah,
I mean,
you see?
I like having physical copies of music, though, and the only way you can download a physical copy for temporary use via Apple is by going to their cloud service, which I do not want to do because I don't want to be on their cloud service. I got, 10 gazillion albums, and I don't want them... dealing with all that. I want to keep it in my own little world. And so I like having physical copies. I'm not near Wi-Fi a lot of the time. I'm driving a lot when I listen to music. So that's not conducive to Wi-Fi listening. And I'm not sold on that aspect of it. But, I typed in the new James Taylor album, the new the Mavericks album, some albums that I just don't own yet. And there they are. Play them for free.
Yeah, that's what I did with Sufjan Stevens, or Sufjan Stevens.
And Sufjan, yeah. Did you like it? It's a very, very depressing, quiet album.
Yeah, and I liked it so much I went out and bought it.
So, did you? Good for you.
Yeah, except I keep trying to put that CD on my my phonograph, and it just won't play.
That's right. So will you be buying Elusive Butterfly anytime soon?
I have no idea what you're talking about now.
I've moved us on to obituaries.
I know that. That was my way of like letting you continue talking about... our Irish singer friend here who
That's right. We've been talking a lot about music. And so an Irish crooner, Val Dunican, I hope I'm saying his name right. He died last week at 88 years old. His family said the cause of death was, quote, just old age. End quote. I love
just
that.
Old age. He
Val Dunican is like the Irish Perry Como or Andy Williams. He was a non-threatening crooner in the Bing Crosby mold. He wore lots of sweaters. He had a TV show for like 21 years from 1965, The Heart of Rock and Roll, through 1986. So he saw it all. And his hits included The Special Years, Delaney's Donkey, which was his big breakthrough song, and Elusive Butterfly, which is the elusive butterfly of love, if you don't know that song. But, you know, if you know anyone over 50 in Ireland, please give them our sympathy.
Well, and Italian director Sergio Solima, who is probably best known for all of his spaghetti westerns, he died at the age of 94.
Yeah, I'm not really wasn't really familiar with his career, but I've seen the Lee Van Cleef film The Big Gun Down. But he did all sorts of genres. He did a big TV miniseries in the 70s in Italy called Sandokan. He did spy movies. He did sword and sandal epics like Goliath Against the Giants. I think his defining element is that he brought a sort of a socio-political aspect to the spaghetti westerns and the movies he made. Whereas in like Clint Eastwood spaghetti westerns, there were no heroes or villains. It was totally an amoral world of survive, dog eat dog. In his movies, the bad guys were always the Yankee colonists, and the good guys were the outlaws and the poor people who were rising up. And so there was a real social commentary aspect to the movies that he made, even though he sort of trafficked, I think, in a lot of B movies.
You know, I wonder, we talked about, you know, the rules in India and in China for releasing a film. I wonder if there's a rule in Italy that to release a spaghetti Western or to even make a spaghetti Western, your first name has to be Sergio.
Maybe.
Yeah. Well, that wraps up today's show. It was a week short on news, and yet we still ran long. But you know what? If you liked what you heard, you can subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, or Stitcher. Anywhere they give podcasts away for free, you can usually find our show there. And we do appreciate it when you subscribe and when you rate and review the show. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us or even ways to contact us. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Again, all of this information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. You know, I almost forgot to mention, you can follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle, or you can like us on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox on our page.
You haven't reviewed us lately. Time to review us on iTunes. Click 5 stars. It doesn't take much effort.
No, it takes less effort to click 5 stars than no stars at all.
We don't ask you to pay. We just ask you to review.
Yes. Or like tell a friend or 900,000.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, the music you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, who is MGMT.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week, my website is astreamisnotasale.com. But if you can't find me there, why not try out my new gaming app? Where will I put my billions?
Oh, my goodness. Well, on that note, you know, if you can't find any of Michael's writing about the entertainment industry there or his coverage there, try the Huffington Post or head on over to michaelgiltz.com. Of course, you can always check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.